The Deep Field.
And welcome to Season 2 of The Deep Field, where we seek to uncover fascinating stories hiding in plain sight. And I'm your host, Cole Shakey. It's nice to be back in your earphones. I know we've had some radio silence this fall, but it's because we've been busy reporting and recording for some upcoming episodes, and we're really excited to bring them to you. In the hopper, we have an episode exploring the changing face and the history of Calgary's Chinatown. And in the new year, we're honored because the Deep Field team will become listeners in residence at the High Performance Rodeo, where we'll create a documentary tribute to the late Michael Green and his performance art piece, The Wailer. But before we get too ahead of ourselves, we have today's episode. And on today's episode, we'll explore...
What's your secret talent?
I taught myself sign language a couple years ago.
What's your secret talent?
I can make hats out of paper.
What's your secret talent?
I can imitate an elephant.
Let's hear.
Nice.
What's your secret talent?
My secret talent is that I can read incredibly quickly.
How fast?
Like lightning.
What's your secret talent?
Well, I've been told that I sound like Steve Buscemi.
It wasn't me. It was Disney characters with my eyes.
What's your secret talent?
I can make pool cues.
Really?
What's your secret talent?
I can do trapeze.
What kind of trapeze?
Stationary trapeze.
How's that different from the trapeze that we think of when we think of the circus?
I mean, it's a lot easier. You don't have to carry people, but I like it because you can do a lot more moves with it without the stress of, you know, falling and breaking your neck and dying. So, yeah.
What's your secret talent?
My secret talent is that I am a very good gardener in that I've been taking care of 3 to 4 gardens every year for the last 2 years, and over the winters I've been taking care of multiple plants, and along with my 3 animals, luckily none of them have eaten the plants yet.
So I'm joined here by producer Anton DeGroot, who had that great montage from the students at Western Canada High School. So, Anton, I wanted to do this with you because we've been talking about this secret talent episode for a while, and it took me kind of an embarrassingly long amount of time to realize what my secret talent was. But then it was kind of told to me by someone else, and as soon as someone said this, I was like, oh, I need to tell Anton about this. But I want to be sensitive to you.
Okay.
So I'm going to tell you my secret talent, but I want you to choose a safe word. And when you say the safe word, I will stop talking.
Okay.
Okay. So what is your safe word?
Let's go with banana.
Okay. Banana. So if you say banana, I will just stop talking until you want me to continue.
Okay.
Okay. So I discovered that my secret talent comes naturally. Because the other day, I was donating blood at Canadian Blood Services, and the needle was in my arm, and I was about halfway through, and it turns out I am an extremely fast blood pumper.
Oh.
And the nice gentleman, the RN who was taking my blood, saw there's like a bag that like squishes back and forth.
Yeah.
And it kind of like slushes along. And he's like, you have such a talent. And I was really thrilled that I'm in what he said is like the top 5% of people whose blood runs out of them faster than anyone else.
Wow.
That's remarkable. It's not something I would have ever thought to have been a secret talent.
Can I? I want to congratulate you because I was pretty sure you wouldn't let me get through that. And I had a whole coded metaphor of like a Slurpee machine that I was going to go into if you didn't want me to describe the blood anymore. Can you tell me how you're feeling and why?
Sure. I will tell you, honestly, I'm feeling a little bit lightheaded. I'm probably a little bit pale. I've never been good with needles. I'm congratulating you on donating blood. That's a really amazing thing to do, and, you know, everyone should do that, but... a little queasy.
You did it. So this is, it's not a talent, I wouldn't say, but it was a secret I knew about you that you have what's it called? It's a biological reaction. It's not like it's squeamishness, but in a very physiological sense. Yeah,
that's right. I understand, there are certain kinds of phobias, regular phobias. What that does is it actually increases your blood pressure. So sending more blood to your extremities, like if you're afraid of spiders or snakes, that will allow you to actually move a lot faster to get away. However, with certain other phobias, I don't know if I go as far as to say that mine is a phobia per se, but if you have a hard time with needles, it actually does the very opposite. It drops your blood pressure. But what that does is it gives you a sense of lightheadedness and queasiness and gives you that blanched look on your face.
That blanched look on your face that I'm admiring right now. I'm sorry for putting you through this, but I found it remarkably hard to come up with what my secret talent was. So when this gentleman said the word talent to me, I was like, well, that's it. And Anton's going to have to edit this sound anyways. So rather it being a surprise in his headphones, maybe I should sit down and talk with him. So take a breath. You're doing fine. I won't mention it anymore. But if you can, do you want to tell me about the first story that we're going to hear?
I recently sat down with my dear friend Nick Hatch, who came in second place at...
the 2015 World AeroPress Championship, and it started with my entrance into the Canadian, the first ever national Canadian AeroPress Championship, which I showed up and, against my own guess of the odds, won. I was then privileged to receive a trip down to Seattle, where I eventually achieved second. I got the silver piston, so that was exciting.
When did you first start brewing coffee?
I've told this story a few times now to people who've asked when they were surprised to discover, like friends of mine who had no idea that I was into coffee. And actually, I first looked it up, I think in 2006, I started looking up and going to coffeegeek.com, which is a little intimidating if you first get into coffee. And then one of my good friends, Brody Thomas, who actually was my coach for all of this, he worked for the now world famous Phil and Sebastian Coffee Roastery here in town. And so I started buying better beans, and I was getting a good grinder because I found out that that was an important thing. And he introduced me to something, a device called an AeroPress in around 2010, 2011 maybe. My parents have always been coffee drinkers. So like even from a very early age, the smell of coffee on like a weekend morning was, you know, an integral part of breakfast, of waking up in our house. And then I had my first migraine headache when I was 11 years old. It was a terrible thing. It lasted days, actually, because we didn't know what it was, didn't treat it right. And afterward, my mom did a bit of research, and at the time, one of the things that, and this is still something that some people do regularly, they prescribe, is caffeine to help prevent and control migraine headaches. So my mom started making me coffee at 11, and I remember it, like, that summer of my life, every morning I'd wake up and she'd make me a like big milky, kind of sweet, iced coffee. Because it was, you know, hot day, and I'd have that. I'd slowly drink that from like 11 till noon, and then I was just wired for a solid hour and a half. But that's what got me into the taste of it, and it became kind of a passion without really knowing like about quality and things like that. I still felt like, you know, I appreciated a good cup because I could handle the bitterness as a kid.
Can you tell me a bit about what it's like to get a migraine headache?
It looks like an afterburn image in my eye, but it's right at the very, very focus, like right where you need to be able to see, to read anything at all. You'd be surprised. You actually only use like a tiny little fraction of your visual field to read. And right there, that's where there's this weird flickering after image. It slowly expands until it fills my entire field of vision on the left side. If I'm away from home, the second I detect it, I need to jump in my car and drive home before it gets any worse. By the time it's actually filled my vision, it also starts to fade just to the periphery so I can now see straight, but I've got this horrible flickering, like, out of the black. It feels like, you know, pressing on your eyeball, so that you actually have this weird, like, you know, pins and needles effect in your actual visual field. And right when it vanishes, you got about 10 minutes, and I can feel the tension in my head building, and then it turns into the most awful, undeniable, unfixable headache that lasts for a good couple of hours. And I've almost learned lately, after, you know, decades of these now, to meditate in such a way that it actually, I think, lowers my blood pressure. And I pass out. I just take a nap. And after about 2 or 3 hours, I wake up with what feels like a hangover. And it's over. And I just get to suffer through a hangover that involved no drinking or fun. So that is a migraine. The pain is something else. And they've studied it and found that it's not like typical pain. You can't take painkillers to kill it, because it's not like it's like an injury. It's like the vein is pressed on the actual pain sensor in your brain, the very sensory input itself. It's like turning up the dial on your pain. So painkillers don't really fix it. Coffee might, I don't know if it can fix it. Like, after you've got the migraine, you're done anyways. But the theory is, if you can keep your veins tenser, which, you know, we're talking about increasing your blood pressure, which happens when you restrict your, you know, your cardiovascular system, which is a byproduct of caffeine, then it helps as a tool to manage migraines. I'm a self-employed contract painter by trade. That's what I do for a living. I've never been actually trained as a barista or paid to make coffees for anybody, but I've been using an AeroPress for years, and I happen to have a slow season for painters in Calgary. That's like January, February, March. It tends to be a little quieter for me than it would be in, you know, July. So I had some time off, and my buddy Brody was working for 8-ounce Coffee Supply here in Calgary at the warehouse, and they had some shipment coming in. They needed a bunch of like detail-itis stuff done for a day, and I'm like, well, you know what, I'm not working. I know the pay is not the same as tradesmen, but I could just work for a day and hang out with you, so that sounds fun. So while I was working there that day, one of the two owners asked Brody if he knew anybody else who would be interested in entering the Canadian AeroPress Championship on behalf of 8-ounce for representation. And that's when Brody mentioned my name, and she's like, oh, I didn't know he was in coffee. And Brody's like, well, he makes an AeroPress every day. He's made it for years. So they signed me up. She just was like, oh, it's $30. I'll sign you up. And yeah, that was that simple. And then I showed up on the day nervous. I practiced the day before. I ended up practicing my cup with Brody. And this is a funny story that some people who don't know what happened would probably love to hear. But Brody was making better coffee than me the night before. In fact, he probably made better coffee than me the day of the championship. But in his first heat, he was up against future third place in the world barista championship, Benjamin Put. Now, Benjamin, he owns a cafe here in town called Monogram Coffee, and he made the best cup of the entire championship, his first round, completely knocking Brody out of, you know, contention. And then for whatever reason, and this is part of the nature of coffee, Ben's next cup was just no good. And so he also disqualified himself in that sense. That's not fair to say. He was fairly beaten by his competitors in his heat, because his cup was inconsistent. And so that's really what happened, is I kept making a consistent cup. I kept making the sweetest, most consistent cup I found. When I asked Phil about it later, he was one of the judges, Phil Robertson, of Phil and Sebastian. And that was it, and then he won, and it was, you know, prizes. It was a scale and some ancillary coffee equipment, and the big ticket being like a flight to Seattle for the world competition.
Anton, can we just jump in for a second?
Yeah.
I've been thinking of these secret talents for some reason as something that kind of comes naturally, like bleeding really well. But this is great to hear about this talent that is secret but very cultivated, very practiced and trained. I just think we need to pause, though, because I don't know what an AeroPress is.
Oh, of course. Right. So an AeroPress is a small handheld coffee maker that looks like an enormous syringe. So at the very bottom is where you place your coffee cup. And then on top of that, there is a little nozzle where there is a filter, and it is packed full of the coffee that you are going to be using. At which point then you take hot boiling water and you pour it into the cylinder. And then once it is steeped for however long that you've decided that you need to steep it for, you then take a big rubber and plastic plunger and you put it on top, and you squish the water through the coffee and through the filter into your cup. And voila, you've got a great cup of coffee.
This is great. This is like, this feels like, as a society, we're getting one step closer to having a coffee needle that you can just literally start injecting into my veins. So I'm now like doubly into this. Let's get back to Nick.
All right. So Nick, can you tell me a little bit about what happened when you got to Seattle, what the day was like leading up to the competition?
Well, it was super early in the morning. We waited around for like an hour for our Airbnb hostess to pick us up from the airport. And we got to the hotel, or the Airbnb, the beautiful little suite. Tried to practice my formula, where I brought my grinder from Calgary. I brought a scale. I had the beans, the competition beans. And I was like, oh, I'll just use their kettle. Well, they had no kettle. She had no kettle in her apartment. So I boiled water in a pot and guessed at what temperature it was. Like, super scientific, Nick. Great. Great practice. I kept finding that the second cup tasted better because it must have been cool enough. I don't know what temperature that was. So that was a total waste of time, but fun anyways. Because then we went right from there. We walked, hiked all our stuff in backpacks, dressed up to the nines for this. Walked across Seattle for like late lunch. Stopped in some divey little bar, bought a shot, asked to use the phone, ordered a cab, and finally made it to the competition. Where, little did we know, I was going to make it to the final round, so we had to stay up all night.
Okay, so what exactly is your formula?
Ah, okay, so this is something, this is how this competition works. So the AeroPress competition is, we all have the same equipment, and we're all using the same coffee. The only thing you're varying is, you know, your grind, and, you know, agitation, things like that, and, like, temperature of water and steep time. Because you're all using the same equipment, and your formula is important to, like, your personal success, you actually have to give your formula up, like, you have to write it down and submit it to the judges before you compete to prove that you haven't ripped somebody else's formula off during the competition. So my formula actually was kind of a ripoff of the previous 5 years of winners. I took the basic ratio that other people had used, so I was using 17.5 grams of coffee to 250 cc's or grams of water. I used the general temperature ballpark. Mine was at 85 degrees Celsius, which I don't think I changed it when I got down to sea level. Probably should have. But, you know, it was good enough to get second place. That's something. And then I was using standard pour-over method. A Virtuoso Barrezza grinder set to 16 grind, or 17 grind, I think, which is like a medium fine. Grind the coffee, pop it in, get your water ready, and do a bloom of about 50 to 60 grams of water. So the bloom is where you pour in a little bit of water at first just to soak all the grinds and to allow any of the excess CO2 to boil off, which is important with freshly roasted coffee. You have too much CO2. If you have too much of it in there, you don't let it boil off, when you're making it, you get too much carbonic acid in your final cup, which makes it taste sour. So I did a bloom of about 30 seconds, and then I top it up, and this is something I stole from the Japanese competitor from the previous year, who had won, the Japanese champion, I should say, Shuichi. So I did a very slow press. My press was like 60 seconds to almost 75 seconds. And then the final trick on the night of was to chill the cup that I poured it into, because it turns out we discovered not only brewing at cool temperatures, but serving it at a cool temperature, like just above drinking temperature, really brought out more of the floral aspects of it and the stuff that we wanted the judges to judge me on.
Can you tell me about some of the other competitors in the tournament?
I was absolutely honored to be competing with people like Jeff Verellen of Belgium, who has won, I think he's won twice in a row and come in third once. He was there. He unfortunately did not place or come in anywhere in the top 10. But like there were 30 competitors, I think maybe 33, from around the world. Like each of those competitors was a different country, with the exception of Canada having two and America having two for silly political reasons. I ended up meeting like probably half the competitors and trying to get to know their names and learn a bit about them. Who ended up winning, it went like this. It went third place went to Kay Ong of the Philippines. And I didn't really get to know her that much beforehand, but we have become Facebook friends since. And I've, you know, got to see her formula, and I think she wished me happy birthday, which is sweet. I placed second. And the winner was this year, for 2015, was Lukas Zahradnik of Slovakia. And he was such a gentleman, not only better dressed than myself, but once he won, he actually handed both Kay and myself the little sample pouches of the actual competition coffee that they'd used in the Slovakian national championships.
For you, Nick, what makes a really good cup of coffee?
Coffee has 4,000 flavor compounds to it, which is about double what you can from wine. So there's a huge amount of variety you can get in terms of flavors off of coffee. And it really is like as complex and fine as fine wine, fine scotch, other fine foods. Me personally, and this is actually apparently like a geographic bias, being in North America, we tend to favor lighter coffee, so lighter roasts. So they tend to be more acidic, be more floral, and more sweet. I've heard in Asia, they like more brothy, a bit more roasty. Obviously, like France and Italy is more of an espresso culture. So I think they might appreciate like more intense flavor, a bit more bitter, or not bitter, but like deeper, roastier flavors. Whereas we're, I think, a lot more similar to Scandinavian culture. And actually, I'm very inspired by Scandinavian coffee culture. Fika, they call it. Is part of like the name for their specific coffee culture.
When you do this next year, if you do this next year, what are you going to do differently, if anything?
I don't even know yet. I've been looking at like doing something really different and crazy because, you know, I'm up to risk it now. Like my first goal when I first competed was just get past the first round or don't embarrass yourself because, you know, I'm a homebrew barista. I'm not a professional barista, so I didn't want to embarrass myself in front of professionals. But having come second in the world and learning a bit more about coffee, I'm like, I'll do something crazy this year or next year, you know, like mix it up, do something completely bizarre.
I have one last question for you. Why coffee?
It's funny, like everybody drinks coffee, and yet I feel like it still has this like interesting exclusive following. Isn't that weird? Like everybody drinks it. It's not exclusive at all, but like when you have that cup in front of you, it's like this magical private moment, just you and the coffee. And especially when I was younger, to have acquired a taste for it, I felt like I was, you know, made me more adult. So I feel like maybe that's it. My journey to adulthood started with learning to enjoy coffee. It surprises me sometimes. I'm just like, oh, this the very private, personal like luxury. It's like this affordable luxury, right? Like, because a cup of coffee doesn't cost a lot to make. But to start my day with it, it's just like, it's this incredible reward. Simple. And I miss it. It can set off my whole day if I don't get the cup. Because I feel like, maybe it's a little bit of ego stroking in the morning. And then, I just feel better about my whole day.
Thanks for bringing this in, Anton.
My pleasure.
It's just nice, isn't it, to have a friend, maybe a friend you've known for a long time, who can just tell you about this thing that they're really into.
Absolutely. I had no idea that was something he loved.
So, speaking of, what's your secret talent?
Oh, I've been thinking a little bit about that. I mean, other than making these podcast episodes, maybe. It's really ridiculous, but probably the one thing that I can do that nobody else knows is that I can play that old Sega Genesis game, Sonic the Hedgehog number 2, from beginning to end, flawlessly. It's been witnessed, and it has no practical use in the modern world other than, you know, a little bit of bragging rights, I guess.
Yeah. I, when I was a kid, for some reason, was really jealous or envious of Sonic the Hedgehog's hairdo, which I know isn't really, it's like a blue cartoon version of Needles, but I thought I would look pretty good if I had that mohawk. Okay, so our next story is actually another friend of ours who has a surprising secret talent that came from their misspent youth. This is our friend Braden Griffiths.
We are in Denny's, the Denny's restaurant on 16th Ave. They've done some renovations, I think, actually recently. So we're sitting in a corner booth. It's been here forever, but it looks very different than it used to, than the Denny's that I remember. Well, I guess, yeah, the reason I say it looks different than I remember is because I spent a lot of time in this Denny's when I was in high school, so that would have been 1999, 2000, 2001. And at the time, I was young in my grade, so I wasn't 18 at any point in high school. So my friend group was never a drinking friend group. I mean, we did some drinking, but it was always so much work to get somebody to buy you alcohol at that age that it just became... It just became drinking iced tea at Denny's was an easier way to spend an evening. And Denny's was open all night. So we would come to Denny's and we would sit here for hours on end and I suspect likely make more noise than was than would be accepted in polite society. And we sat at Denny's. Thanks.
Would you like me to box this?
Sure, that'd be great, actually.
I'm sorry, you're doing your...
No, it's good. I'm going to eat that grand slamwich later.
I will box this.
Thank you.
So thanks very much.
So we weren't a drinking bunch by trade, and so so Denny's was a place that would accept us late into the evening. There was never any goal when we were here. We would just sit around and I think just be teenagers together and tell stories and talk about how important the theater that we were creating was and talk about hopes and dreams and. And be in love with the people who we were dating at the time, like very in love with the people we were dating at the time, and generally try to make each other laugh, I think. And so I think, do you want me to go into it? Do you want me to tell? Okay, so thanks so much. The service here is very good now, as we've learned today in our experience at Denny's, and it's a lot cleaner than it used to be. So we discovered, I think, one night how it started happening. I'm not actually sure, but we got into utensil magic, and somehow we got spun around to seeing who could actually hang a spoon on their nose and who couldn't do this. But it turned out that there were a number more places than just your nose that you could hang a spoon. I think it started with, I could hang two spoons on my nose. And that was miraculous. Oh, the reason that the renovation is important is because the utensils used to be generally clean, but not wholly clean. So they were excellent utensils for hanging because I think they were just a bit stickier than you would find in a regular home kitchen. So I found out pretty quickly that I could hang two spoons on my nose. To fit two spoons on a nose, you hang one just gently fading. Oh, no. You need to do it both at the same time. So you approach at the same time, and one goes on the sort of... You need to have a fairly big nose, which the Griffises do have. So that was good. So you approach at the same time, and you hang one on the generally right side of the nose, and one fades to the left. And then the hard part is they sort of cross, like the... They end up hanging, the center of gravity crosses the stems of the spoon, and then you just find a tenuous balance. And so, having hours ahead of us at Denny's, we started looking for other places on your face that you could hang spoons, and the chin was an obvious choice, and then one just underneath my eyes, and then two on each ear. Which eventually added up to, two on each ear, which is four, two on the nose, six, cheek, seven, eight, and then one on the chin, which was nine. So this was a great achievement. There were pictures taken, and so that was sort of, this was a miraculous party trick that I figured out that only I could do. So there was lots of people there, but only I could achieve nine. So, not having much to do as a teenager, I think as a lark, I looked into whether there was any sort of record for hanging spoons on one's face without adhesive. And my understanding at the time was the Guinness Book of World Records was the only sort of recording of the records in the world. And so I looked at this book. I worked at... Chapters at the time, and I looked at the last couple of Guinness Book of World Records that we had in stock, and there was nothing that said anything about spoon hanging. So at the time, I assumed I must be the world record holder for hanging spoons on my face. And so I wrote a handwritten letter to Guinness. In the States, I didn't include a picture. I just said I could hang nine spoons on my face. Was this a record? Question mark. A couple months passed, and I got a letter back, like in the mail. So not electronically, in the mail. I got a letter back stating, no, we have no record of this record, of this being something that exists in our record book, and we will send somebody to verify. So, now this might be apocryphal, but I believe the guy that ended up showing up at this Denny's was from Edmonton. I think we set, we made a gentleman's agreement that I would have an hour to do so, and I hung 9 spoons on my face. We shook hands, and he left. And then I had grown to manhood. We firmly shook hands, I should say, as men. And I felt... I do recall feeling that this lark had gone too far at that point. In fact, I don't even know at the time that I had told anyone that I had written. I think I had told my brother that I was going to write, but I didn't tell anybody at the high school that I had written. So we firmly shook hands, and then about, I don't even know how long after, I received a certificate and a written letter that I was the record holder for hanging spoons on my face without adhesive. And a very short time after that, I received a letter that said I was no longer the record holder for hanging spoons on my face without adhesive. It was within months. Like, I still hadn't graduated high school by the time I got the letter saying I was no longer the record holder. It had the name of the person who had broken my record. And I tell people he was a kid from Texas, but I'm going to be honest with you. I actually don't remember where he was from. So that is just an embroidery that I've added to the story over the years. But he had somehow figured out how to do 11. He had somehow figured out how to, it was a he, had figured out how to do 11 on his face. In preparation for this interview, I looked up on the internet where the record stands now. Now this was, I might pull it up here while we're sitting here, but the record is now, it's something silly, like 36 spoons on the face. And my understanding is a lot of those spoons are achieved on your forehead. So there's like, so I guess those with more of a Neanderthal cast of the brow are able to achieve free-hanging spoon on above the eyebrow. It was a simpler time, and I thought I was a man, but it turns out I did still have growing to do. And I got wrapped up in life pursuits, like going to university and learning how to be an adult, and I forgot about my spoons. So, to tell you the truth, I have very little paper trail in terms of the tracking of this record. So, my understanding is that I was published in the larger Book of World Records, which is essentially... I like to imagine it's a big book that's held under glass somewhere. But I actually don't know. I don't know what it is. It's probably just a filing system somewhere. And then of those records, the most photogenic are chosen, or the most bizarre, like the longest fingernails or whatever it is, are chosen for like the published world record book that you can buy from Stacks in Costco around Christmas time. Like lingerie, the most expensive lingerie that's made of encrusted diamonds or something like that. Like that'll sell. That'll move books, man. And truthfully, when you have 9 spoons hanging on your face, it's an ugly sight. Like it is, like all, you look like you're a melting candle a little bit, because everything is sort of being pulled down naturally by gravity. So I remember being proud of it at the time, but I also remember feeling I was a popular kid in high school, but I wasn't like the most popular kid on the block, and I remember feeling slightly embarrassed by it. I don't remember feeling overly proud of it, to tell you the truth. It's become a delightful story that I can now tell, but at the time, it's a silly thing, and I remember being a bit embarrassed by how silly, like, because I had put in some amount of work. Like, I had written a handwritten letter to the Guinness Book of World Records. I had put some amount of effort into this very, very silly thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I was proud of it at the time. I don't know that I'm proud of it now, actually, to tell you the truth. But it has become a bit of a... It's a funny anecdote that I can now tell. And I've never felt like I was a very good, anecdote or storyteller. So... it's one that I feel is a good go-to in terms of, it's not even a break the ice story. It's like 4 weeks into a friendship, I will drop this and that'll take us to the next step of friendship. Well, in terms of thinking about sort of the Guinness book at the time, and the reason I would even have considered, emailing or writing a letter to them about these spoons, I think it was a novel thing. It was, and you know, I mean, I worked at Chapters, and we would always get this flat, and it was usually around November we would get this flat of Guinness Book of World Records books. And I remember thinking, as I shelved these things while working at the bookstore, the book felt very, very similar. It looked about the same size. But there was something interesting in this idea that there had been enough achievements made in the last year that it justified publishing this little phone book size paperback book. And it was physical, like it was a physical thing at the time. Whereas now what I'm discovering in my prep for this interview is that it's all recorded online, and so it's not as physically prevalent nowadays, this thing, this constant reminder that people are achieving something somewhere, no matter how silly that achievement was. And there is sort of a sassy quality to the Guinness book, because there are records that are like, this guy just didn't cut his fingernails for 36 years and now he's got this gnarled tree growing out of his hand. And that is an achievement of some kind, and it's worth recording in a book. And so I think, knowing that there were these sassy records at the time, I was like, well, I can hang 9 spoons on my face. And that's a silly, sassy thing that's worth recording somewhere. And maybe the ego of believing that that needed to be recorded is actually the thing that I'm embarrassed about at this point. There was, I don't know, there was maybe, and this sounds like a person who's getting old complaining about what's been lost, but there was a semi-permanence to this published book. And I think the art of reading something in the bathroom has died to a certain degree. Because I do remember we had a Guinness Book of World Records in the bathroom. And so every time you'd go into the bathroom, you would discover something new and weird about the world. And now, obviously, people take their phones into the bathroom, and that's the thing that they're looking at. But you were sort of... you were trapped in this room to perform your ablutions. And you were trapped with sort of a National Geographic, a Guinness Book of World Records, and, like... your mom's Chatelaine magazine, and the Guinness Book of World Records was the go-to, and you would discover something weird and wonderful that somebody had done somewhere, and that was your discovery for that afternoon. So, you know, quite honestly, it might have been time in the bathroom that spurred me to phone, that spurred me to phone, contact, email Guinness Book of World Records to try my hand at being the reading fodder for somebody else in the bathroom.
Here we go. Faces pressed up to the glow.
The third and final talented friend that we'll introduce you to today is my buddy Meg Brehm. Now, over the last few years, Meg and her husband Will have been delving deeper and deeper into the secretive world of bees. Here's Megan and I in her sunny Bowness living room.
What is the, like, what's the learning curve? Like, when you're getting into beekeeping? Like, when you're kind of discovering things like this? Like, what's the sort of voyage of discovery that you went through?
Everything is learning by disaster. So, from the first moment, you will be doing things wrong. Because when you... I took a course with a lot of old-time beekeepers, but... no one agrees on anything. So they argue and you sit there and you leave being filled with things that you don't understand. Some of the big disasters that we've had is we've had bears get into our bee yard. So you do need to have an electric fence. We used to throw out our wax because we didn't think there was any use for it. Now we make candles out of it. It's, you really should go into a hive as little as possible. Because they know what they're doing. But we started with one hive. So we were like helicopter beekeeper parents. And we went in all the time, which I think was a huge problem and set them back in their honey flow. Also, if you notice that they're getting too full, you have to separate them or they'll swarm. So that happened our first year. We had a swarm. We were really lucky because we had an empty hive nearby and they swarmed into that hive. So it became very, very lucky.
And what does it mean when... or they will swarm. What does that mean?
It means that there's too many bees for the room. And so they create a new queen and the old queen leaves with half the hive. And it's the way that hives reproduce.
If you didn't have that, if there wasn't that spare hive, is there like war?
No, that half the hive will fly away and you'll never see it again. So it could be in a tree 2 kilometers away, and it happens every spring. So Will is on a swarm catching list. So when somebody in there finds a swarm in a tree, and it's terrifying to look at, they'll call the swarm catchers and the swarm catchers can come and get them. And it's great because then you can get a free hive, like free colony.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And you're called a swarm catcher.
And you're called a swarm catcher. Yeah. Yeah. And they don't really sting you when they're swarming because they fill up on a bunch of honey to keep themselves going. So it's, people freak out. A lot of people kill swarms, but they're so full of honey, they can't really bend their bodies enough to sting you. So it's really the safest time to handle them with naked hands.
Yeah.
But it's the most terrifying looking. And also, it takes a while to get used to standing with like thousands of bees flying around you, and it does make that horror movie hum.
Yeah.
Like when you pop the top, it's that low hum.
How did you guys get into beekeeping?
We went to a garden show, and when we were there, I saw a beekeeping booth and I was like, whoa, we should do this. This would be so fun. Sort of not thinking it could happen. And then I took a course just because I was interested. And then my father-in-law, who has land out in Cochrane, surprisingly was really interested in the idea. So that's, it kind of was like a whim that people indulged, and now it's gone quite far. And now it's Will's whim, and he is obsessed with like growing the hives and having more and more hives and having this sideline business.
How many hives do you have now?
16. He wants to double it by next year. Yeah.
When they swarm, like is it exponential? Like is it, do they essentially double every summer?
Hopefully. I mean, they have to get through the winter and there's a lot of bees who don't survive the winter, and I mean there's a lot of bad beekeeping that contributes to that because you have to leave them with enough honey that they can survive, and you have to place them together to keep them kind of warm. Yeah, but that is the idea in the most ideal natural world, is that a hive grows and grows and grows, splits, and then you have two hives, and then they'll continue. A queen can last about 3 years, so she could swarm a few times. All the other bees only last about a month. Hmm. So that's the other thing, is like a queen has to watch every single one of her children die. It's a weird job. It's a very weird job. I think being a queen is the worst. Like, when I found out how she mates, and also a beehive is 95% female, and there's drones. Those are the male bees. They do nothing. They help with nothing. They sit around. They wait. They eat. They go out once. They meet up with other buddies. They have this weirdly aggressive sexual interaction where their penises break off, and then they die. That's their whole, that's the only job they do. Honey is, it's the only really naturally sweet food. It's the only food that doesn't, it doesn't ever go bad. It will never ever go bad. Your honey will crystallize, but it will never ever, if it was collected at, when it was, all the comb was capped, it will never rot. But the way it's made is that bees collect nectar in their stomachs, then they go into one of the comb cells and they barf it up like numerous times, so it mixes with their stomach enzymes, and then they fan it to dry it out and thicken it. So like, that's another thing too, we have honey, it's delicious, it's beautiful, it's made of a zillion blooms. It is barfed up bee food. That's what we are eating.
So good, though.
It is so good. It's so good. Yep.
Now, Meg's not at all secret talent is that she is a Governor General Award nominated playwright and just straight up one of my favorite writers around. So to close the show, we offer you a marriage of her two talents. For The Deep Field, Meg has written a monologue about queens, queen bees, queen envy, and a lot more. The podcast is yours, Meg.
The Reluctant Queen. Things tend to look good from far away. When in between jobs, in between lovers, and in between directions, royalty can look pretty damn good. But if you're pining over Kate's wedges, don't forget Diana's pumps. There might be a reason the young royal is rebelling with flats. During an argument about fidelity with the prince, her mother-in-law famously took a tumble down the palace stairs, ending up in hospital. Kate's decision to have her heels on the floor might be a way to stay grounded, step gingerly, and, well, if need be, it's just easier to run away. Little girls' adoration of princesses seems an unavoidable stage in development. The 3 to 8-year-old set universally lusts after glittery dresses, gauzy outfits, and heads full of enough hair to induce migraines. Set in lush historical settings, the reality of being married off before puberty is conveniently left out. It's no different in the insect kingdom. The term queen bee is tossed around in admiration, often referring to being bossy, being in charge, but always being in power. Like Diana's tell-all book, I'm here to pop the fantasy of what it means to be a queen bee in a busy hive. A queen bee is born into her role. As a larva, she's fed royal jelly secreted by the heads of the workers she will rule. She develops into a shapely specimen that is more buttock than any other part. This is her best asset, pardon the pun, as it will ensure she can fill her role as queen mother. Once she has clawed her way out of the comb, she will be evaluated by the workers. If not up to snuff, she'll be killed on the spot. If accepted, they will dedicate themselves to her pheromone and follow it loyally. The queen will then set off on her maiden flight. This is the only time she will ever leave the hive in her life. A virgin queen will fly up into the air, Not as a royal tour, where the greatest hardship is to look interested in other countries' national holidays, but to attract the gang of young male drone bees who have been flying, looking, and waiting for her. Once she's been detected, she'll be simultaneously mated with, in mid-air by several bees from different hives. Best described as an acrobatic gangbang, each drone fills her with his semen. Once the drones have ejaculated into the queen, their penises break off and they die. The queen, filled with several genetic strains, shakily makes her way back to the hive where she will spend the rest of her days laying eggs. A healthy queen is expected to lay at least 1,500 eggs a day, giving new meaning to the pressure to create an heir and a spare. She's fawned over, fed, and protected so long as she is laying. There is no hierarchy in the hive. It is perhaps the best example of communism in the natural world. The organism is the hive itself, and each bee can be sacrificed for the good of the whole. Once tired and perhaps not laying enough bees, the workers will begin to raise a new queen. The new queen, younger, fuzzier, and soon to be filled with fresh semen, will usurp the old queen. There will be no royal celebration with clover boughs and pollen patties in recognition of the old queen's contribution. She will be killed, dragged out of the hive, and pushed off the ledge so that she may decompose unceremoniously with the ants and mouse shit below. So knowing this, who am I to ruin 1,000 Disney movies and girl power music videos that delight our culture? Looking like a grump with a severe lack of whimsy, I feel I hold a terrible secret as a beekeeper. As Halloween gears up and a myriad of princess dresses scatter the streets, my mind cannot help but fill with that old platitude. Be careful what you wish for.
Thanks to Nick, Braden, Meg, and Miss G's drama class at Western Canada High School for joining us and sharing their now not-so-secret talents. And thanks to Alberta Theatre Projects for the support. Now, you can find us on iTunes, where you should subscribe, and on Facebook or Twitter, where you can get in touch with us, or on the website spiderwebshow.ca, where if you haven't checked out this website before, you really should, because there's a ton of cool stuff. The Deep Field is lovingly created by myself, Cole Chakey, Anton DeGroot, and Laurel Green here in Calgary, Alberta. Hey, Laurel, what's your secret talent?
I used to sing in musicals. Oh, and I can do the box step for you.
Thanks for listening. Till soon.